come to order. We have two members testifying in other committees, and they will try to get their bills passed before the committee shut down, so we will start without them. And the first three bills, the lobbyist that wants to testify isn't here, so what we'll do is start with the last one. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2764A. And Everett Cutter and Claudia Howell, would you like to come up, please?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2764 authorizes the relevant public authority and interest to submit a claim for lump sum reimbursement from Great Crossing Protection House for a gate or signal project at a railroad crossing. And House Bill 2764 passed the House unanimously, and there are no amendments.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Everett Cutter, manager of the Oregon Railroad Association. I represent the two Class I railroads that serve Oregon, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe and the Union Pacific Railroad. This bill was introduced at the request of the Oregon Railroad Association and, as noted, was passed out of the House Transportation Committee, passed the House floor, and can come to you about any opposition or amendment. What this measure does, it simply allows a second alternative lump sum method of reimbursement from the state grade crossing protection account administered by Oregon Department of Transportation for costs incurred in safeguarding highway, rail, public grade crossings. The proposed alternative reimbursement method is permissive. It is not mandatory. It would not replace the present method, and its use requires agreement by the Oregon Department of Transportation. The grade crossing protection account helps pay for installation of or improvements to automatic signal devices installed at crossings. The actual work is performed by the railroad companies and public road authorities, who are then reimbursed by the grade crossing protection account. Under the present law, the railroad or road authority may submit progress claims based upon actual costs, capturing a bunch of indirect costs, which is very time-consuming and a lot of paper involved. It's tedious, labor-intensive. Under the proposed alternative lump sum method, ODOT will work with the railroad and the road authority to establish a safety project estimated costs in advance, and these costs will be stipulated in a regulatory order as well as in the project financial agreement. So it's based on an estimate, and then during the course of the project, the railroad or public authority will submit a claim for, say, materials, stockpiles, going into the project. And then at the end of the project, the remainder of the estimated amount would be reimbursed from the account. With passage of this measure, funds can be dispersed during the project as expenses are incurred that cannot exceed the agreed-upon total amount. And then the department, along with railroads and road authorities, would hold periodic review meetings to ensure that we're current and that the estimates are on target and that the system is working as intended. This lump sum method is currently being used in at least 13 Western states, and tentative agreements exist in two others. Passage of House Bill 2764 will enable the department, railroads, and road authorities more flexibility in managing the costs of highway rail crossing safety improvement projects, and will result in administrative cost savings for all parties concerned. Thank you very much.
Do you know of any states that had this and then stopped doing it? I know it's 13 that do and two more.
Madam Chair, no, I don't know of any that have rejected it. The trend has been towards that.
Claudia?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Claudia Howell. I'm manager of ODOT's Rail Division. We believe that House Bill 2764 will improve how we disperse funds for highway railroad grade crossing improvement projects. We've been looking, as I think we've talked before, about ways to reduce the overall cost of the project because the amount of money we get has not changed appreciably in about 10 years. And so even a small amount of money helps. We think that this will give us a little better way of controlling costs and accountability, really on all ends, our end, the side of the road authority, as well as the railroad, to establish the cost ahead of time, put that in a regulatory order, and then not have to simply reimburse, as the law requires now, the bills that come in.
Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Yes.
Anybody? Yes. Senator Yee.
It seems to me that the current process is to bill for actual cost, and the process you're proposing is to bill the estimated cost. And I don't understand, how do you improve accountability by reporting estimates rather than actual cost? Because you say this will improve efficiency and accountability.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, right now we have to pay the bills as they come in from the railroad and the road authority based on their actual costs. We don't have any control over that. If we are able to establish ahead of time what the cost will be, and I think then we don't call it an estimate, we actually call it a hard number, then we actually control the cost of the project rather than simply having to pay the bill that shows up in the mail.
No, but you're reporting not the actual cost. You're reporting estimated cost. So I don't see how it improves accountability, because actual may be less than estimate. And at the time when we are asking for cost accounting, so we know better what the actual costs are, and here we reverse to estimates. And you're also talking about, you're trying to capture indirect costs. Now, indirect costs can make a lot of difference in the cost of a project, whether you charge it to administration or you charge it to actual project. So if you're trying to capture indirect costs, and on the other hand, you're giving us an estimate, I don't see how you can give us a better picture of the cost by giving us estimates.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, the railroads are confident that they can provide an upfront estimate of the cost of a project within just very minor percentage points. Sometimes it may exceed, sometimes it may be below, but in theory and in actual practice in other states, it does even out. The savings is in the paperwork, the labor-intensive work that goes into billing under the current system. And I stress, this is not a mandatory alternative. This is permissive. It is intended on the part of the railroads to be used only on the simplest cases. If you're standard cookie cutter, if you will, crossing signal projects. The more complicated projects would not be used, and of course any of these would require, or the Department of Transportation agreement and approval to go into the contract. So, and of course these projects are still subject to the same audit procedure as under the current method of payment.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm concerned that if we give them an option, they'll opt for the easy way to do an estimate rather than use the actual cost. I think, especially when indirect cost is involved, do you remember I asked ODOT, what is your administration cost for a DMV? And the auditor said it's 38%. And ODOT used a different definition of indirect cost, and their administration cost is much less. So it can make a lot of difference when you estimate indirect cost. it will make a lot of difference in reporting what is the cost of the project. And indirect cost, you're not using actual and you use estimate.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator, do you want to follow that up a little bit? Unlike other ODOT projects, these projects are actually done by the railroad and in most cases a local road authority. Right now, we really don't have the ability to determine ahead of time what the cost of the project will in fact be. We issue the order, we tell them what they need to do, and then they bill us for what are their actual costs, not ours. So the indirect costs are not our indirect costs, they are the railroad and the road authority's indirect costs, over which we now have no handle on at all. So what we're attempting to do is to determine up front, so frankly we can better budget, what the cost of the project will be. Some of these projects are reimbursed over as long as a 2-year period. And sometimes they come in under what we thought they were going to, and sometimes they come in over. And we don't have any ability to go back and say, you know, that's not what we think you should be charging for that project. And so what we're attempting to do here is to, in fact, get a handle of those costs. From our standpoint, we want to protect as many crossings in the state as we can with the limited amount of money that we have. So we're highly motivated to keep the cost of the project down to the absolute bare minimum. And I think the railroads are too, because I think they are equally motivated to have those crossings improved.
They do give an accounting for how the money was spent. Even though it's at a lump sum, you do know, it's not that this is just a lump sum without an account, actual accounting of what they did.
And under the lump sum, indirect costs are included, of course, in the overall total.
Okay.
And those are available, as I say, for audit.
And, mm-hmm. Madam Chair, and they are audited.
Okay.
Every one of them.
Yes. I was just wondering, does the lump sum payment help you at all in terms of leveraging the federal dollars that you get for these projects too? Does that play a role in helping with that, or does it not matter in terms of leveraging those dollars?
Madam Chair, Senator Steele, the federal government is also looking at using this, I think, for the same reason that we've looked at it. And I think in talking to them, we will use the same procedure with the federal money. So I don't think it improves our position. It does improve our ability to control the cost.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I just want to say, Madam Chair, that lump sum billing process is based on estimated cost of the project. So I just feel at a time we're asking for cost accounting, finding out what is actual cost of the project, of the program, of the administration cost, and to reverse back to estimate.
The only thing
is consistent what we are doing in asking for accountability.
Except, Senator Yee, funds may be dispersed throughout the project not to exceed the agreed amount. So once you agree, yes, fix this crossing for this, and you've agreed you're going to pay for that, and you look at bids or whatever, I can see where it would be more prudent just to pay what you promised to pay.
Madam Chair, this gives the state the hammer over the railroad to keep the cost of the project down.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But when they sign a contract, they're not supposed to exceed the amount anyway. But if the actual cost is less, then we should pay the lesser amount.
If you've agreed to pay $15,000, do you think it's not going to reach $15,000? If you've agreed to pay it?
or not to exceed the amount.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so you're not asking for a lump sum over what you agreed to. That's what they're saying. They may bill you for what you already agreed to pay for this, and they may have to justify anything over it that you're not going to quibble anymore. Isn't that what we're saying?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Right.
But, mm-hmm. Well, I just believe we can get more accountability if they report the actual cost.
I assume if it was our employee, but we're hiring somebody else, and they need to have the, you know, they make sure they're getting the most for it. But we've agreed to pay for this amount, so that's all. We may agree to disagree. Are there any other questions? Okay, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2764 and open a work. Yes, you're welcome. Thank you. And open a work session on House Bill 2764.
Madam Chair, move House Bill 2764 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Castillo has moved House Bill 2764 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Well, I have stated my reason that the current practice is more actual and more accountable.
So you're probably going to vote no?
Yes.
That's okay. Okay, is there any other discussion? Then the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Berryhill?
Aye.
Senator
Reed?
No. Aye. Having received a majority, the bill moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Castillo would like to carry it. Okay, and I close the work session on House Bill 2764. Yeah. Okay, but I think I'll work the other one. Okay. What was the next to the last one? Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2440A. And Joanne Flint of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Is Joanne here? I mean, Department of Education. She was here. She's in the hall. Do you want to tell us about the bill?
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2440A is the graduated license bill, and it provides some restrictions for new drivers. What we're looking at today is the Dash 6 Amendment, which transfers the driver training program from the Department of Education to the Department of Transportation and gives some specifications of what the Department of Transportation is to establish and develop in that program. There's also Dash 7 Amendment, which changes the age of the person supervising the 5,200 hours of driving experience from 21 to 25.
Yes. So whose amendments are the Dash 6s then? Would that be the committee amendments, or is it?
That actually came up
Well, it could have been. I asked for it.
Okay.
I thought that it would be better to move it, and we talked about it, so we maybe Mike knows too.
Sure.
Why don't you come up, Mike?
And then the Dash 7?
Right. Yeah, I was going to have her talk, and then we were going to go through the dashes.
Madam Chair, my recollection, the amendments you're asking about are the ones to move the administration from the Department of Education to Transportation.
Mm-hmm.
That was a result of the meeting that you and I had with Renee and Susan in your office.
Okay, that's right. Okay. That was my list. Okay. Okay. Thank you, Joanne. Well,
thank you. Joanne Flint from the Department of Education. I think have very brief statements about these amendments, the Dash 8 amendments, which I was asked to address today. The Dash 8 amendments do move the responsibilities for both the administration and the curriculum development in traffic safety education, renamed from driver education driver training, to the Department of Transportation. They make a number of other changes, which I think when we look at them all together, clearly make a fairly complete move
from the Department of Education to the Department of Transportation. We've previously had concerns when only parts of the responsibilities were moved, but this appears to shift the responsibilities entirely to the Department of Transportation, and we have no objection to that. We don't know how this will work. Certainly, it will be interesting to observe what occurs in the case where another agency or an external group has established a curriculum. Local school districts have the option of whether or not to adopt that curriculum, and that would be the case here. A local school board would make a determination whether or not they wanted to provide traffic safety education programs within their school. The requirements that are spelled out and those which I would expect would ensue would be substantially more than is required now. I think that a local school district would find some additional expense in offering programs, although I will tell you they would be upgraded programs. The improvements, I presume, will be funded by an increase in the license fees, because certainly with the amount that the Department of Education receives, we could not provide reimbursement for tuition to the local school districts at an adequate rate, and certainly with the additional expenses that we expect this to entail for local districts, I'm sure that would be absolutely necessary if we were to hope to see at least even the same number of traffic safety education programs available for students. The moving of the deletion of the requirement for TSCC licensing really again moves it out of the realm of school district responsibility. So it's a fairly complete shift, and one that the department has no objection to.
I just want to say something and thank you for that, because it's come to our attention over several times that driver's ed doesn't always reduce accidents, but it does when there's the curriculum that the Department of Transportation develops. It has a record of success and reducing accidents. And one thing that makes it attractive to me is I think they have a budget of $82 million. They know how to write their staff. And do you know how many at the Department of Ed are working on this program?
We currently have a half-time staff person working on the program.
Right.
And even with that, we're able to send very little money back to the school districts to reimburse for tuition.
Right.
We have often been able to send back only 50%. $150 is allowed. We have been able to provide anywhere from roughly $80 to $130, the high.
Right.
That's the best we've been able to do with really a fairly low overhead. In other words, a half-time person. So, and it's not a full professional staff.
Sure.
At that. So
we're kind of excited. I'm glad that you are making it easy, because we see an opportunity, and hopefully the federal programs that they can qualify for, you know, for traffic safety or whatever, and so we're glad to have your blessing.
I will indicate there is one portion of this that we are looking forward to having the Department of Transportation address in a significant way. It's a concern that we've had for quite some time, and that is that those people who teach the behind-the-wheel portion of the training have not had any requirements other than licensure or 6 hours of coursework, and that certainly is, if you think about the responsibility of a person teaching someone to drive, to not even have a specific license like they do for school bus drivers, it's really been very, very troubling to us to have those people, many of them just out of college themselves with certainly no adequate driving training themselves, even potentially being able to teach the behind-the-wheel portion. And so we look forward to some very significant improvements in the criteria for teachers or for people who are teaching our children to drive, and hope that will occur.
Thanks. Do you have questions of Joanne Smith?
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on that, if I may, Madam Chair.
Sure.
So your concern has been the qualifications of the way the current system is set up, that perhaps the people teaching the courses aren't as qualified as they maybe could or should be.
Madam Chair, Senator DeCio, yes.
Okay, thank you. And Troy, would you come back?
Yes. Another question.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is there any minimum requirements we have that require the trainer to have? I mean, we don't have any minimum requirement for the driver teachers.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Yee, the requirement for someone who teaches the classroom portion is that they're a licensed teacher. There is no no type of license required. In other words, you could be a beginning PE teacher, a beginning social studies teacher, beginning anyone licensed, elementary licensed teacher. That was the only requirement for the classroom portion. The behind the wheel portion did require, if you were not a licensed teacher, 6 hours of instruction or professional development training. And we're very hopeful that with this change that will be improved substantially.
Oh, so the change is in the amendment.
The amendments, Madam Chair, Senator Yee, the amendments, I believe, will provide a substantial review of that, and with the opportunity for ODOT to establish criteria for those teachers, I think that we will see an improvement in that situation, yes.
And before I add, I just want to say that I received a note from Tricia Bozak from OEA, and I wanted her comfort level, and they've been researching this. She laughed, but she said, I talked to Kelly Taylor at DMV, and we can work out my concern about teachers doing the classroom portion of the instruction through the rulemaking process, as long as our legislative intent is there, you know, that we have a high quality. Go ahead.
Quite solid. Mm-hmm. Transportation Safety Division Manager for Oregon Department of Transportation. Actually, I believe Joanne answered the question so far, so there's nothing at this point that I would add other than possibly answer some other questions about the amendments themselves.
Okay, well, do you have some?
I guess I'd like to ask Troy how he envisions it working. How do you see this program actually being carried out with the department?
Madam Chair, Senator Castillo. In the Dash 6 amendments, we'll be charged with establishing the curriculum standards and instructor standards, working with the Transition Safety Committee. There is a pretty broad list of individuals that we would invite to be involved with establishing the various pieces of the curriculum, standing committees, or some expert work groups that would need to be brought in. Those that are involved in teaching now or delivering the course now, which isn't always the school district. They have some subcontracts out to community colleges or to private vendors. And we would try to be as open in the process as we can, also taking into account some of those states that have shown recently that the curriculum they're using, both in the classroom and behind the wheel, is shown to make a difference.
But they're using the Department of Transportation's curriculum.
Madam Chair, in some cases that's accurate. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. And Mike, you want to add anything for the record, for intent or anything? Okay. Can you stay there? Then what were the Dash 7?
The Dash 7 is a
question. Okay, the person supervising the 50 hours or 100 hours of training that they have to certify when they get their driver's license from 21 to 25. And one issue that the council brought up was that another statute, 21, is all you have to be to supervise someone with a commit period. And this would only, the 25. Your age would only change in this bill.
So it confused things. Yeah, it would confuse things. Okay, so what are the Dash 8? pull that to 12 to midnight.
That changes mm-hmm.
So the 8, I think we would be in trouble with our bill with the dash 8.
Well, I recommended that because the research showed that the most accidents happen at 9 o'clock from 9 o'clock on, is according to the statistics.
I know.
Mm-hmm. So I think that situation makes it harder for people to drive as soon as it gets dark. So 12 o'clock may not be late enough or early enough to prevent accidents. So we start at 9, maybe we can prevent more accidents, according to the statistics.
Now, isn't it true, though, that the deadlier ones were after midnight? There's more, like, fender benders, but the worst ones? I don't have that statistic right in front of me. Does it say the severity of them?
Well, it says the serious injury is 213 at 9 compared to 187 and 193 at 10 and 11. And then crashes totaled is 646 at 9 o'clock. And then it goes down to 539 and 472. So that's the reason I feel for the first year, maybe we should stop driving at night. Besides, we have exceptions for school activities and employment. Do you have this sheet?
Mm-hmm. Which one? Let me see which one you have.
So if we want to present...
You have the 17. Okay. Mm-hmm. I will show you both. Okay, 9 p.m. Incapacitating. Yeah. Okay, Mrs. Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the Kelly Cater. Senator Yee, one of the things when you and I talked about hours before, I failed to tell you, and I probably want to shed some light on this. It's really, I mean, if you really wanted to get at when most of the accidents happened, it'd be 3 to 6 in the afternoon.
That's right.
And yes, there are more accidents at 9 than there are at midnight. But from what we've seen around the country and in the states that have already done this, it's most prudent to start with the midnight to 5 a.m. And that really does show to save some lives. And so if you wanted to get to the most accidents, you'd really be keeping kids from driving after school, 3 to 6. And that's probably not very practical to get any bill through. So I just wanted to let you know, I've forgotten to tell you that before, that really the bulk of the accidents happen actually in daylight hours. But what happens after midnight to 5 a.m. is you've got fatigue and you've got some, you know, some more careless type behaviors going on. And it really matches up with the state curfew law, too. And that's why the midnight to 5 a.m. was picked, too, to kind of match curfew. And it wasn't really so much where the bulk of the accidents happened, but where we know some very dangerous accidents happen, and we wanted to try to save a few lives. So I wanted to just add that to the record, Madam Chair, as you guys were discussing that. Yeah. That's all right.
Now, I think, Senator, making it to 9, I don't think the House would concur, just to be truthful. Now, I'd rather have the bill.
Have you talked to representatives?
I talked to some other fellows over there.
Mm-hmm.
And when Senator Montgomery, Representative Montgomery, did he testify on this?
Yeah.
What did he say about that? Did we ask him that?
I don't know if we specifically asked him. I know it was a test in the House at the time. They really worked on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
I just went back and forth over the time.
I think, Madam Chair, I think at that time, what we told that people wanted to go from 1 to 5 a.m. rather than midnight, and midnight seemed to be the one that was compromised with people.
It probably.
Not sure.
That's right. I remember.
During the House discussion, the three starting times they debated were 11 p.m., midnight, and 1 a.m.
And so they compromised.
Midnight.
Right. So if they didn't concur, and we had, you know, just kind of slow it down, and I think they would concur with what, with the dash 6? Dash 6. And I think we should, my opinion is, I think we should just adopt the dash 6.
Mm-hmm. Well,
Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. I also talked to the parents who testified mm-hmm. at the last meeting, and they all support the idea of 9 p.m., but I don't want to jeopardize the bill in any
sure.
way. So for political reality, I'm going to withdraw my recommendation.
Okay. Then, is there anyone else that would like to, is anyone signed up?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would like to ask, since Senator Tro is down as one of the co-sponsors and his aide is here, is Senator Tro okay with the gas 6 amendment or the gas that we're looking at?
Yes.
Yes, 7.
Madam Chair, Senator Castillo, mine's Grassfield. I'm Senator Tro's legislative aide. From the conversations I've had with him, he's okay with the dash sixes.
Right.
From what I understand, although I don't want to speak for him, Representative Montgomery is too. So I don't think there's any problem.
His office told Megan he is okay with the dash six.
And then how about the dash sevens where we changed the 21 to 25? Has he had a chance to consider that, do you know?
And Chair Senator Castillo, I haven't had a conversation with him about that particular part, but that was part of some recommendations that we made initially. So I think he would probably be okay with that since we initially suggested that.
Oh.
But given what you said earlier, it sounds like it might confuse things.
Legislative Council said that it would be different ages and they, it was kind of their recommendation that it be standard.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense too.
All right. Thank you. So. Okay. Then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2440A. Open work session on House Bill 2440A. And I'll move the dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2440A. Is there any objection? And I move House Bill 2440A to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
So we're not going to move dash 7.
No.
Mm-hmm. Leave it all 21.
Well, my recommendation is, of course, my children are all past that, but I would recommend to every parent show them these statistics just mm-hmm. educate.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully it will be in the curriculum and educate the people. So. Mm-hmm. All right, then, is there any other discussion? Okay, I've moved, Chair has moved House Bill 2440A as amended to the floor with a due pass. The clerk will call the vote.
Senator
Castillo.
Aye.
Senator Yates.
Aye.
Chair
Shannon.
Aye. I've received a majority of our committee. It is passed and I'll carry it.
Want Senator Cho to carry?
He can help. Senator Cho and I will carry it. Okay. Okay, then. That's the next one. Sure, we'll start at the top now. That's the first one. Did I close the work session? Close the work session on 2440A. Okay. And now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3521A. Is that your bill? Oh, well, just in time. And Megan Corral will explain to us this bill as Representative Minnis. Comes forward. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3521 allows sellers of motor vehicles to sell vehicles subject to future acceptance by lender debt and finance sale. It prohibits sale of trade-in vehicle before a seller has obtained acceptance or approval of a lender. And when requests for consumer financing are rejected, it requires the seller to return to the buyer all things of value received from the buyer as part of the transaction.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Karen Minnis, District 20, East Multnomah County. I appreciate you hearing this bill. The Oregon Automobile Dealers Association, as well as the Independent Auto Dealers, worked with me on this piece of legislation. There was a problem where car dealers first of all, let me just preface my remarks. I think most car dealers are honest and they do a good job, so I don't want to lump them all in together. But there are some that would, this happened to my niece. She went in, made a deal on a car, sent her home in the new car, and had traded in a car that was in very good condition, was paid off. I called her 2 weeks later and said, sorry, you didn't for the loan, you need to bring the car back. And so she asked for her car to be returned, and they said, sorry, we sold your car. So they put her, and so it just turned into a nightmare on her. We checked into it, and there was nothing prohibiting the dealers from doing this. Well, we felt, as did the other two organizations, that we would introduce, make it clear that, you know, they need to return traded in if indeed the financing isn't in order. So that was the impetus of the bill.
I'm surprised they would even release the car if the financing wasn't in order.
Well, they do. They do. They send you home, and I think that's pretty common practice. I think they do a primary check, and they weren't able to sell the contract, and so they had to enter the car. Both of the organizations have been wonderful. Recognize there are those out there that.
But I have a question. If you're the car dealer, you're in the business of buying and selling, and if you have a buyer of this good condition used car, money, time is money. Why would you have to wait 2 weeks? That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Well, they came back to her after 2 weeks, and I don't know why. It shouldn't usually take that long, and I don't know why in this particular instance it took 2 weeks. That is how long the car dealer waited. And this is instance. I don't believe that's customary.
And the car dealers not just concerned about this, right? And they support the bill?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Would you like them to come up? And
no, they raise their thumbs.
Oh, they can. Okay, come on.
All right. Okay. Right. Go ahead, Dan. Okay. There are amendments?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Now, let me give you a brief history of why in certain cases vehicles would be sent out the door without the financing secured on a vehicle. We fell out that the 1995 session allowed in a retail installment contract a blank line for the financing company on a motor vehicle contract. If you go in and we sell a lot of cars on the weekends, and of course all the banks are closed on the weekends, so we'll do a preliminary credit check on a consumer and have a pretty good idea of what rate we can get them financed at. So we fill out all the paperwork, the percentage rate, the payment, everything that goes into the contract except for the name of the company that's actually going to buy the loan. And then come Monday, we start shopping the loans that we've done over the weekend to get finance companies to buy them. Most of them are done, probably 95 to 98% of them are done on Monday for the weekend. Those people that have either haven't been employed at a certain location for very long or they have some problems with their credit history, those contracts can take longer to sell. And in rare cases, those contracts can't be sold. We think we can sell it at a rate, but for whatever reason we can't. And so we have to bring the consumer back in and say, we thought we could do this and we can't. So we're talking probably less than 5% of the deals, maybe even less than 2% of the deals that are done on a daily basis. So most cars that are traded in, come that Monday, we can sell the traded-in vehicle. But in those small number of cases where the financing is still uncertain, we believe it is appropriate to hold on to that traded-in vehicle until we're sure that the financing is going to be found in the contract. Now, on the House side, the Attorney General's office introduced an amendment, which is included in the A. Engross bill that we had some questions about. We've worked with the Attorney General's office, and you have before you some consensus amendments that make it clear that while the dealers are responsible for returning the trade-in or anything else of value, including a down payment, if the financing can't be purchased, the consumer also has an obligation to return the vehicle to us. But there are occasions when we call up the consumer and tell them we're sorry the financing can't be bought. You told us you'd been employed for 6 months at this place and actually you've only been working there for 4 months and so we can't get the contract bought. And the consumer says, okay, and 10 and 12 days later, we're still trying to get the car back. They're out there in a free car. And believe it or not, they can hold that car as long as they want, and it's never considered theft, as best as I can tell. And Pete Shepard from the Attorney General's office may disagree with me, but from what I understand, if they write us a bad check, go out the door, the check bounces, and the contract doesn't go through, they've got that car, that is not necessarily considered theft. That's just a civil matter. So we wanted to ensure that the consumers had an obligation to return the vehicle. We also wanted to make sure that they damaged the vehicle while it was in their possession. If they took the vehicle on a Friday afternoon and went down to L.A. and back before we called and told them that the contract couldn't be purchased, we believe that they ought to be able, that the dealer ought to be able to charge a reasonable mileage charge for the time that they had the vehicle in their possession. So that's the amendments that you have before us. And my understanding is that both the Department of Justice and OABA and the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers have agreed to those amendments.
Okay. And you, have you seen the amendments?
I'm happy with them. I haven't seen them, but they're one of them. I don't have any questions.
Oh, sure. Isn't it?
Well, it's
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Molly King. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers, and I've been in front of the current trend here. I've been held out a couple times.
Right.
Sorry. He has been held out a couple times, so stuck with that.
Okay.
I want to let you know that Oregon Independent Auto Dealers does support this bill, and that less than 1% or 2% or whatever it is that does this type of thing is not what we want.
Okay. Thank you. Is anyone else signed up? Pete Shepard, Department of Justice.
Okay.
Anybody have questions?
Oh, I just want to know, Madam Chair, was there any opposition in the committee? In the House committee? No.
Was there any opposition on the floor? Okay, good.
I'm Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section in the Department of Justice,
okay,
where we do handle consumer complaints involving car dealers and other kinds of businesses. We do support the bill. I think it's been accurately described to the committee. It's a fair, balanced proposal that comes before the committee, and it does deal with a significant consumer protection problem. We applaud both dealers' associations for and representing Minnis as well for helping on this issue. Closely parallels legislation introduced pre-session filed by the Attorney General to deal with the same problem. So we're glad the legislature is taking action on it. Let me just reassure the committee that it can be a crime to steal a car from a car dealer. I was a deputy district attorney in Marion County, and I actually prosecuted such a case. So it does happen, and there are other remedies that a car dealer would have against a consumer who failed to return the car. But the bill is fair in placing some obligations on consumers as well as dealers.
Okay. Thank you. If there are no more questions, we'll just go into work session. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3521A and open a work session on House Bill 3521A.
You want a motion?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I move that we move
8-2.
House Bill 3521-8-2. We adopt the amendment.
Okay, is there any discussion? Without objection.
Madam Chair, I move that we move House Bill 3521 A and growth as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Okay, is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I just need to declare a potential conflict of interest because my husband does do advertising for car dealers.
Yes, okay. Then the clerk will call the roll.
Ms. Cleveland?
Aye.
Mr. George?
Aye.
Mary Lee?
Aye.
Mr. Shepard?
Aye.
Mr. Shepard?
Aye. Having received unanimous vote, the bill, House Bill 2738A will, as amended, will go to 35. Sorry, I was looking at the wrong one. 35-21A, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Yee will carry the bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 35-21A. And now we'll open a work session, I mean a public hearing on House Bill 2738A. Thanks. Yeah.
Nice to see you. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2738A increases from 20 days to 90 days the validity of a lien based on a Department of Transportation transitional ownership record. It defines the date of sale for purposes calculating the 90-day period as earlier of the date of sale, date the contract of security interest was signed, or recording the lien on the primary or and there are dash 3 and dash 4 amendments that the witnesses will.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller again with the Oregon Auditors Association, and perhaps Senator Castillo should just declare a conflict of interest.
This is Daryl's thing.
House Bill 2738 is a fairly technical bill. In order to secure a lien on a motor vehicle, the lien is attached by listing it on the title. But frequently we do not have the title in our possession when we are selling a vehicle because we've made the payoff to the bank, but we're waiting for the bank to return the title to us. So the legislature several years ago created something called a transitional ownership record that allows us to perfect a lien while the Department of Transportation is waiting to receive the title to actually perfect the lien on the piece of paper. That transitional ownership record is valid for 30 days. And we have to file the lien within 20 days of selling the vehicle, or we lose our protection under bankruptcy statutes, federal bankruptcy statutes. So it's rather important that we make sure that security interest is perfected. The problem is 30 days can expire, and we still don't have the title. Especially with bank consolidations, we can send a payment to a clearinghouse in Florida who then has to contact a clearinghouse in New York where they're actually warehousing the titles, and then they send it by Pony Express sometimes to Oregon, and it can take 6 or 8 weeks to get a title. Now, we are working closely with DMV, and I know the chair last session worked very hard on some different technology programs with DMV to allow electronically entitling, and as soon as the Y2K thing gets solved, the Department of Transportation is going to move more towards electronic filing of liens. It may solve a lot of this problem. But even if we move hastily after the year 2000, for that program to be online statewide could take 2 or 3 years. So all this bill does is extend the useful life of the transitional ownership record lien from 30 days to 90 days to make sure that the new lien on the vehicle is secure. The amendments that you have before you, be the first one, which is the dash three. Dash 3 amendments to the A and Gross bill. On the House side, we inadvertently forgot to change 130 to 90 in one statutory reference. So all the amendments do is change 130 to 90 that needs to be done to make sure there's not a conflict in statute on how long the lien is valid for. There's another set of amendments that has been introduced that we are not opposed to, and I'll let the person who's responsible for those amendments describe them to you, but we do consider them a friendly amendment and a problem with the committee adopting them if that is your preference. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about the purpose behind the bill.
Would you be happy to answer any questions?
Well, that'd be broad, Manny.
Like, where were you at 12:01 this morning?
I was in line at the cinema getting ready to watch Star Wars.
Star Wars?
I had, since you asked, I'm going to explain.
You look pretty alert.
I was at an 8:15 hearing this morning. But my next door neighbor, 17-year-old kid, was 84th in line, and I told him I'd buy his ticket if he'd buy me one. And I thought 84th in line for episode 1 of Star Wars, I'd probably get a ticket to see it sometime this evening. Well, he stood there in line, and he called me up and said, I got you a ticket for 12:01 a.m. And he was so excited. I wasn't as excited, but it was kind of fun to be there. What I found most interesting is we got out of the theater at 2:30 in this morning after watching the show, and there were over 250 people lined up for the 3 a.m. showing. So,
and one of them was my son.
That's right. I got a ticket to this. And just so you know that I'm not the only one, Craig Campbell went all the way to Eugene for a 12:01 showing of the episode one as well. So and then he had to commute back home. So I got to bed before me.
Yes.
So
was it worth it?
Right, that's what I want to know.
When Star Wars first came out in 1977, I was in fifth grade. And it's hard to recapture that youthful enthusiasm for a movie, but I'll save the tickets then.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other germane questions?
No.
I have a
germane question. Yeah, I didn't mean to
offend. Actually, the Star Wars ones may be easier.
I want to know, why do you want 90 days? Wouldn't 60 days be enough?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Yee, 60 days would be better than 30. 90 days is better than 60, and in some cases it takes us even longer than 90 days to get the title back. What we're trying to do is capture as many of the titles as possible by going to 90 days. Give you an example. There's a bank, and I'm not trying to suggest that all the problems are with the banks. I mean, a dealer can get a car and wholesale it to another dealer, and then that dealer sells it. You could be three or four dealers out. The first dealer's got to get the title and send it to the second dealer, who sends it to the wholesaler, who sends it to the fourth dealer, before liens start getting perfected. So it's just mail time in getting titles from one location to another to make sure the lien perfection is done can take an awful long time. And when you are dealing with banks that warehouse all the titles for all their car loans across the nation in a single warehouse somewhere in New Jersey, and the payment centers in Ohio, it can take quite a bit longer than 60 days in some cases to get those titles back in Oregon. And if we have a 60-day lien perfection and the DMV gets that title on the 65th day, then we've lost our prioritization in terms of that lien. And what happens in reality with our relationship with the banks, by the way, is if a consumer goes bankrupt, the banks will expect the dealer to reimburse the bank. The banks don't take the loss in those bankruptcies. It's the dealership to sell the vehicle that takes the loss. So if a consumer within 90 days of purchasing this vehicle goes bankrupt and the dealer has not secured the lien on the title, then the customer who goes bankrupt gets to keep the car, and the dealer pays the bank off for the loan. So the dealer pays for the customer's car because the customer went bankrupt, and the reason why we have to pay for their car is because we did not perfect the lien in time or because we couldn't get the title in a timely manner. And so I would have gone to 120 days, except I thought that was going too far, and I didn't want people to get too nervous. We went and talked to DMV and other people in the industry and tried to figure out the best way to capture most of the titles that are slow in getting back without going too far out, and 90 days seemed to be the number that most people were comfortable with.
I just want to say, in a modern age of using faxes and email, not Pony Express anymore, I just thought maybe we don't need 90 days. But
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, and faxes and email are not permitted by law at this time, and we will be going to email electronic lien entitling as soon as the Department of Transportation can get it online, but that's still probably 2 or 3 years out. And in between here and there, a lot of dealers could pay for cars that they shouldn't have to pay for because they can't get that lien perfected. I would agree with you, and our dealers would love to go to a web-based or a computer-based system where they can instantaneously pay off a lien on a motor vehicle and have DMV, have the banks release the lien on it to perfect new liens all by the stroke of a key on a computer. And the technology is there. DMV has got a pilot project that they're prepared to do, but all of their technology employees are working on solving the Y2K problem. And until that is done, and the Department of Transportation is sure that their computers aren't going to crash, this is kind of a second-tier item for them.
Okay, Mark, did you have one?
No, it's okay.
All right, Gail, why don't you just sit there, and we'll have Department of Justice. And Paul, why don't you come up too, Paul? And Pete Shepard. Well, what's your name? Is it Pete Shepard?
And sure, maybe I signed the wrong. That's another possibility.
If you're not prepared on this one,
I haven't heard Mr. Ford say anything I disagree with yet.
Okay, thank you. That's good. Okay, Paul.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Pasgrove, and I'm representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. We are an association that includes a lot of lenders who loan money on cars, both to allow consumers to purchase them from dealers like Mr. Fuller's members, and also sometimes those people come in to get loans for other purposes and offer their car as collateral. And we're the proponent of the, we support the bill. We think it's a very good bill, and it addresses an important problem, and we strongly support it, plus the A3 amendments that Mr. Fuller described. We have also proposed the A4 amendments that deal with another technical issue that is almost the same, but coming at it from a slightly different perspective. And I'll try to be brief in my discussion of it, because it also has days and times and 90s and 20s, and it gets a bit confusing. When we finance vehicles, we do it in two classifications, what we call purchase money, where we're loaning the money for the person to buy the car, and that's what we call purchase money, or non-purchase money, and that's when we loan money that the car's used as collateral, but it's not to buy the car, it's used for some other purpose. Currently, under Oregon law, we have 20 days to perfect our security interest in a purchase money loan. And if we do that, either by getting the real title and getting it to DMV, or by doing the transitional ownership document that you heard Mr. Fuller describe, then that perfection relates back to the day we created our security interest. It's called the relation back if we do our perfection within 20 days by either of those two methods. And that works for purchase money, but it does not work for non-purchase money. And what this A4 amendment does is create the same type of 20-day relation back for non-purchase money loans that current Oregon law has for purchase money loans. And it does that by amending ORS 803-100. I'd be glad to answer any questions you have about it, but it's essentially the same kind of an issue, is to make sure that loan secured interest on vehicles get perfected, and Mr. Fuller also described what happens in some cases if they don't, and that would be the same kind of problem that we would face if this amendment wasn't adopted.
Okay. Just more of a comment than the question, but it appears to me with the interaction that has to occur relative to that title and who has a lien and this sort of thing to actually today have required that you had to physically have that title would certainly be improved when we get to the point that this can be electronically done. When you make a transfer, it is here in this segment, and be able to track that so that we're not chasing a piece of paper.
Madam Chair, Senator George, couldn't agree with you more, and I know that's Mr. Fuller's view. All of these, we do have the technology available. We're not quite there to implement it, but it is kind of an old-fashioned way to literally say we have to have a particular single piece of paper, the original piece of paper, and move it around all over through all of the various dealers and wholesalers and banks and finance companies and back into the DMVs of various states. And of course, if you switch states as you sell across state lines that we're going through to DMVs, and this piece of paper literally travels physically all those places. When we can get to the point to do that online, we will all be much better off.
Mm-hmm. I had a comment. I had a trailer one time that I bought on an auction. Title was guaranteed to be present. We did have a problem with the fact that it was a Washington-based trailer. By the time I got to the end of that, I was thinking about cutting it up in pieces and throwing it in scrap. It was an amazing process to file. I stumbled across it recently. It's about this thick. And you were thinking, man, if they could have instantly guaranteed that that was the title, it's not giving me my money back. And we would have known that when I walked out of there with that piece of machinery that I had a title to. So it's a problem. Like, I'm glad we're going to finally get there. Great thing.
And Chuck, I made one more comment. The A4 amendments were, of course, reviewed by Mr. Fuller and gave you a comment. I also sent them to DMV, and Kelly Taylor talked to their assistant attorney general, and they have approved it and not had any problem with the A4 amendments as well. Kelly is, I think, here. She authorized me to make that statement. Thank you.
Okay.
I'd be glad to answer any other questions.
Okay. Are there any other questions about the bill or the amendments? Okay, then we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2738A, open a work session on House Bill 2738A. And are there any amendments about the, let's see, which dash one?
You want to make
yes,
I move that we adopt House Bill 2738, Amendment Dash A3.
Is there an objection? Without objection.
And Madam Chair, I move that we adopt Amendment Dash A4.
Is there any objection? Without objection.
And, Madam Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2738 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Is there any more discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
I, with the same potential conflict of interest as stated previously.
Aye.
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 I haven't received unanimous vote. The bill passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. That is House Bill 2738A as amended. And Senator George, would you carry the bill?
I will. Yeah.
Okay. It will close the hearing on House Bill 2738A. Open the public hearing on House Bill. Oh, they want us out of here, don't they?
No, we have to get
out. Oh, okay, I can't. There's a, I see a reflection. Where are you going?
Well, I'm going to my committee, but I'm going to do public hearing, so you're okay.
Oh, we're okay. We have three. We're okay. Okay.
I need a few. Can I have a
second? Sure. Okay. All right.
One more?
Yes. Are we, is that right? We'll, now I open a public hearing on House Bill 2738A, which...
39.
Oh, at 2739A, right? And Megan, will you describe the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, we have a vehicle bill. It modifies vehicle dealer certificates by increasing the amount of bond or letter of credit required, extending the term of certificate to 3 years, and increasing fees for original issuance and for renewal. It creates a public value to maintain continuous bond and letter of credit coverage, which is punishable by a maximum fine of $5,000 for 10 years of prison. It also increases the fees for additional dealers.
And Mr. Fuller, I don't see an amendment.
None.
There's none proposed. Okay, tell us why we need it.
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Darrell Fuller of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. House Bill 2739A makes three changes in the law. First change is it moves our dealer licensing from annual renewal to renewal every 3 years. That saves paperwork headaches for dealers and paperwork headache for DMV. When we originally talked to DMV about this, they were pretty giddy, in fact, because they process somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 dealer applications every year for renewal or new licensing. And by going to every 3 years and staggering those out, it saves DMV from shuffling an awful lot of paper that they don't need to shuffle. And so DMV and dealers alike would appreciate the money that would be saved and the time that would be saved by not having to process those licenses every year. Second change of the three that it makes is it increases the bond required to be an auto dealer from $15,000 to $25,000. That stepped to $20,000 in March of 2000. And the $25,000 in September of 2001. The bond required to be an auto dealer has not changed since, I think, 1951 or 53. I can't remember what year the legislature last changed that bond, but it's a long time in coming. This is a good move. It's a small move. We would actually support increasing the bond higher. But in order to get all the stakeholders willing to agree to the bill, we've moved it from 15 to 25 over a two-year period of time. The third and final change made by the bill is kind of an archaic one, and that is on the dealer license application, you currently have to get the local government to sign off, physically put a signature on the license application, that the dealership is located at a place that is zoned for a dealership, for a motor vehicle dealership. And while that had some use a number of years ago, it sort of lost its useful life. Local governments already have a lot of zoning authority, and this doesn't hinder their zoning authority at all. But local governments learned that because dealers have to have that local government signature, that they could start attaching a price tag to that signature. And so some localities now are charging up to $100 for the signature, in some cases perhaps more, to sign off that a dealership that's been in the same location for the last 30 years still has the same zoning approval that it had 30 years ago. I contacted both the League of Oregon Cities and the Associated Oregon Counties to find out if they had a problem with removing that. They were a little disappointed to lose the money, frankly, but really didn't have any need for that sign-off. We did keep the sign-off requirement for new applicants so that they could ensure that a new dealership was located in some place where a commercial business ought to be located. And if a dealership should change location, they would have to get that local government sign-off. But if the dealership is at the same location has not moved, that it would not need to get the local government sign-off in order to get their license renewed. Three fairly minor changes, but they're significant in that they have a positive impact on dealerships in Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Well, do you think the cars will be cheaper now that they don't have to pay the city?
Well, we're increasing the bond. The bond will be more expensive, so I think one will offset the other, Madam Chair.
What? Increasing the bond, what?
Increasing the bond. Well, with a $10,000 increase in the bond will cost more money, so that'll probably offset.
Well, isn't the bond increase to keep out upstarts?
It's not to keep upstarts out, but it is to make sure the people that start in the auto dealer business have some financial credibility. And to ensure that they have to meet some sort of hurdle before they get into a business where you're dealing with the second largest purchase in most families, that most families have. And so the desire is that the bond actually serves two purposes. One is it is a place that consumers can go if a dealership goes broke and the consumer was hurt, they can sue the bonding company for recovery. The second aspect of that is they do have to qualify for the bond in order to get a dealer's license. And so that sort of hurdle, if you will, is an important aspect of having the bond.
Okay. Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes,
Madam Chair. Daryl, how often do people sue for the recovery of the bond? I mean, recovery of damage?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I don't have that number. My recollection in talking with bonding companies is that it is not frequent. Bonding companies have an indemnity agreement, and I think we've got somebody from the bonding company here that can probably answer that question better than I can. There's an indemnity agreement between the bonding companies and the dealerships, so if the bond pays out, the dealer has to reimburse the bond. So if a judgment goes against the dealership, it doesn't make sense for them to allow the bonding company to pay it. The dealership's going to pay it if they can, because the bonding company is just going to turn around and get the money from them anyway. So the only circumstances in which a bonding company would pay out for a claim would be if the dealership has gone broke or somehow is out of business. And that is, I think, fairly untypical. There are a number of dealerships that go broke every year, but that doesn't necessarily mean that consumers are left holding the bag, if you will. It would only be in the circumstances where consumers were left having made a down payment, but never receiving the vehicle they purchased, or some other circumstances where they paid something and don't get anything out of it. But that answer would probably be best left to Mr. Powell, who represents the bonding company.
Okay. Oh, so you mean the dealer pays for the bond when they're sued? The bonding company, they don't pay the amount. It's the dealership that pays the amount of the litigation.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, essentially that is correct. A bond is protection in case the dealer can't pay a judgment. If the dealer can pay the judgment, then the dealer is responsible for paying the judgment. So if the dealer can pay it but doesn't, and the bonding company is forced to pay it on behalf of the dealer, then the bonding company is simply going to go after the dealer to be reimbursed. So it doesn't make sense for a dealer to let the bonding company pay a claim that they can play, because they know that the bonding company is going to come back and get the money from them anyway. So the purpose, and John, you can chime in any time.
Yeah.
So the purpose of the bond is in the case that the dealership fails and does not have any assets available for the consumers to get a hold of, if you will.
Oh, so...
So it's not an insurance policy. It's different than an insurance
policy. Oh, it's not like an insurance policy.
Mm-hmm. And now we're getting into a very murky area, and I refuse to answer any questions about the difference between a bond and an insurance policy.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right,
let's go.
Pete Shepard. This is the one.
Come on, Marnie. Kelly Taylor from DMV told me that she needed to leave, but DMV supports the bill.
Okay. Well, actually, with all the changes, there's no opposition, so. Okay. But it's nice to know that. Marnie, go ahead.
Senator Shannon, members of the committee. I wanted to say one more thing. There is a fourth element in this that everybody seems to forget about, but since I put it in there and with an amendment in the House, I thought I would say something about it. There is an amendment that says any dealer who's been revoked, suspended, whatever, in Oregon cannot go to another state, get a dealer's license in another state, and then come back into Oregon and operate as a dealer, say as a wholesaler at any of the auctions. Okay, it doesn't sound like much, but right now none of the states have reciprocity, where if one state takes away a license, they can just go to another state and get another license, okay? And there's a reciprocity, though, where if an Arizona dealer comes into Oregon, they can operate as a dealer at the auctions or wholesaling to dealers, okay? This would say, if you've been revoked here in Oregon, you can't come back here with another state's license. I was in Niagara Falls on Friday and Saturday, and the subject came up. With a group of about 20 other state executives have the same position I do, and I think we will see the same thing happen in the other states. So, and the other states are very interested in this element. So Oregon really is going to be the first one with that, and we will see it probably in another 20 states in the next 3 or 4 years.
Okay, thank you.
I'm chair, members of the committee, Pete Shepard. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section of the Department of Justice. We do support the bill. In particular, we support the element of the bill that achieves a long-standing goal of at least two attorneys general of raising the bond amount. We support the bill. We appreciate the fact that the car dealers have come forward with this proposal. I do want to very gently disagree with Mr. Fuller on one aspect, not to ruin the afternoon. When a dealer goes under, it's almost always the consumers who are left holding the short straw. And in fact, today I learned of a dealer in Eugene who had taken a consigned car from a consumer at least the complaint was made just within the last several days, and then had resold that consigned car without paying off the lien on the car, and then had closed the dealer's business. Under those circumstances, the consumer now is faced with the prospect of paying the lien holder off, because she still has a contractual obligation to pay that lien. But she doesn't have custody of the traded-in car or the consigned car any longer, and the dealer's out of business. And those are the circumstances where the bond is really the last possible hope for the consumer. We applaud the increase, and we hope you will approve of the bill for that reason, but we shouldn't go away thinking that we've solved this problem, because this bill does not solve that problem. It's a step in the right direction, but it doesn't solve the problem.
But you're not opposed to it.
No, not at all. In fact, okay. We support it. We think it's okay. The right thing to do, and we urge you to do it, as we did in the House. But we shouldn't all go away from this session thinking that we have solved that problem. We haven't.
Okay. Thank you.
So do you think the bond should be higher? Higher than $25,000?
Madam Chair, members of Committee Senator Yee, my association's policy is that we would like to see a $50,000 bond. There are other associations, including the Manufactured Housing Association, represented by Don Miner, who's not here today, that has some concerns about a bond that high. I can't speak for Monty, but I'm pretty sure that there are aspects of the used car industry that would prefer not to see a bond that high. If the bond had kept pace with the price of inflation from 1951 into today, the bond would be about $250,000. That would decimate most of the used car industry and probably take a good number of new car dealers with it. because the cost and the requirements of getting a $250,000 bond would be pretty significant. So I don't think anybody would advocate the bond ought to keep price with the inflation over the last 40-some-odd years. But a $15,000 bond is pretty easy to acquire. $25,000 bond is a little more difficult to acquire, but we still believe that the hurdle ought to be somewhat higher than that.
Well, I just think it should be higher, but I just, to be realistic, maybe $25,000 is what you
think. It's a good first step.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Is that it? Okay, then we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2739A and open a work session on House Bill 2739A. I don't
remember anything. Can you
give
a motion?
Okay, I do.
Move that we send House Bill 2739A and growth to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, is there any discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
I, with the same potential conflict of interest as declared previously.
Okay.
Clary
Yee.
Aye.
I, having received the majority of our committee, House Bill 2739A goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Farioli will carry this bill. And is there any more business to come before us?
I,
1 o'clock on Friday. I do want to know that we have some bills that we haven't. We might not get through on Friday, but we will be opening up again. There's some kind of transportation bills coming over from the House package. And the President said he would open us back up for a meeting.
Oh, it doesn't mean we're not going to work anymore after Friday.
Nope, doesn't mean that. Oh, it doesn't mean that every bill in our committee is dead. Okay. So, in fact, there's a two that we're working on amendments. So.
Oh.
Okay. So there's no other business. See you at 1 o'clock and see on the floor. Can we adjourn?
Okay.